Project implementing Bill 1579, briefing and public hearing. Take it away, please.
All right. Well, good afternoon, right? Good afternoon, Chair Carpenter, Commissioners. Thanks for the time to come before you today and talk about HPA civil authority rules. My name is Morgan Carlson, and I'm the director of the agency's Habitat Program, and I've got a partner here. You want to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Randy Thurston. I'm a manager in Morgan's program.
Excellent. So the reason that we are here is that, let's see. So the reason that we're here talking with you today is that during the last legislative session, as a result of the focus on the health of our southern resident ICA, there was a bill passed by the legislature that gave the Department of Fish and Wildlife additional civil authorities and civil tools in the implementation of our hydraulic project approval program. So I'm sure you all recall that that's the permit that the Department of Fish and Wildlife manages and issues in the circumstance of construction projects in or near state waters. So we're at the step of coming before you, providing a full briefing about that rulemaking, some of the options that have been considered. And I think we'll talk a little bit later about the remainder of the timeline for the rulemaking. So as I mentioned, there has been quite a focus, as I'm sure you all recall, both from the work of the department and from the coverage that was in the media, that the plight of southern resident orca really has come into focus over the last couple of years. The governor convened an orca task force that had a broad suite of membership and representation, and they really took a look at what are the factors affecting orca and how do we work more quickly on recovery of orca. One of the factors that they looked at was the availability of prey for orca. And as that committee, that task force, looked at what they could do in the state system to try to make a difference, they focused in on regulations that protect fish and protect fish habitat, of course, believing that that is going to make a contribution to where we have natural origin fish and habitat for those fish, making sure that we're protecting that as part of recovery. So the bill that they passed was House Bill 1579, and as I mentioned, that bill noted that one of the limiting factors for effective implementation of our hydraulic project approval authority is whether there were civil enforcement tools commensurate with the tools that other natural resource agencies and local governments have. Let's go ahead. Again, as I mentioned, the intent there, big picture, is increasing the abundance of prey for those orca. I think Randy and I are going to make a handoff here quickly, but in order to cover kind of the big picture, there are a handful of rulemaking objectives here that come from what the bill directed us to do. And Randy, would you like to make the handoff here?
Sure.
Okay. So Randy's going to talk a little bit about the details. But again, the big focus of the rulemaking, the big focus of the bill that we're responding to, is figuring out how to implement the direction the legislature gave us about these additional civil authorities to improve compliance. Maybe the one thing I will add in terms of the big picture, and we'll talk a little bit more about this at relevant points, it was very important to the legislature to direct the department to use a technical assistance first approach. And so the bill itself codified a system of compliance and civil enforcement for the agency that asks us to start with technical assistance to applicants or people who need to get an HPA, trying to use that technical assistance to help people be in compliance with the law. And the bill and the resulting statute are very clear that that's the approach we need to take. It's modeled off an existing statute, RCW 4305, that directs natural resource agencies in exactly that manner. Use technical assistance first to the degree we can, and it doesn't pose more risk. Let's help people be in compliance with the law. So as you hear us go through the remainder of the details and the options that we considered, you'll see that technical assistance first approach.
Okay, I'm going to walk you through the rulemaking objectives. The first one was adding a procedure for a prospective applicant to come to the department and request a determination about whether their project that was proposed above the ordinary high water line would require an HPA. So this was added to address some concerns about a person may not know if their project needed a permit or not and might not set them up for success in terms of compliance. The next objective was to clarify that the department can disapprove a new application received from a person who has not complied with a stop work order or a notice of or notice of penalty or notice to comply. And so that is a new tool. So if somebody just disregards those notices, doesn't pay their penalties, then we can disapprove their application for up to 1 year or until such time as they actually come into compliance. The third thing is that there was a statute that was repealed for single-family residence bulkheads and rock walls. And so we had to remove any language related to that statute that was repealed from the rules. We've been doing compliance and effectiveness monitoring, and we just completed the fifth year report. And in that report, we found that it's really important that the department have good benchmarks on our bank protection projects so that we can go back and ensure that the projects were complied with the location requirements. And so the next objective requires that those benchmarks be part of the plan submitted as a complete application.
Again, an important part of compliance, so that if we're going back later to check if people have complied with the permit we issued to them, we need to make sure we know how to measure where distance, particularly with bulkheads, is an important part of compliance.
Then we also clarified the compliance sequence, as Morgan talked about a couple of minutes ago, which ranges from that voluntary compliance through technical assistance and what's called a correction request to kind of more increasingly stricter tools like the stop work, notice to comply, or a notice to penalty. And then adding those new tools, that stop work and notice to comply, to the rules. And then we also had to specify a maximum penalty amount, which we'll talk about in a little more. We'll talk about more detail. And lastly, we had to provide a penalty schedule and also specify who could issue or authorize stop work orders and notices of penalty in the rules. And those are the objectives. So there's quite a bit there.
So one of the things that keep going. Okay. One of the things that we heard, we had a brief conversation about this in the Habitat Committee, and you'll see later many of the pieces of the bill that was passed and the subsequent statute were very clear and very detailed. And so there's significant parts of the rulemaking that are fairly straightforward in terms of taking the language that was passed in the statute and pulling that over into rules. Randy's going to focus today on the pieces that require more analysis of alternatives and discretion. So that's mm-hmm. the bulk of the presentation we're going to cover today.
So I just kind of just wanted to go over real quickly about what you have in your notebooks. So these are significant legislative rules, so you have a lot more materials than you typically get for rulemaking. So you have the summary sheet and the CR 102 notice. In the CR 102 notice, there is a draft small business economic impact statement. And then you have the rule changes to the five sections of rules that we're proposing to that we need to make in order to include all the changes that were in the original bill. And then the last thing you have is the draft regulatory analysis, and that has the least burdensome alternative analysis along with a cost-benefit analysis and some proposed determinations.
So we're going to cover most of the detail I think you need for the briefing. There are a couple of points I think we're going to call out where it may be helpful if you do want to follow along with materials in that large stack.
So, as Morgan said, most of the rules being proposed are nearly verbatim with what from the bill or the resulting statute. So we're going to focus the next few slides on the key policy decisions that the department was directed to make, and these include, again, specifying who has the signature authority for stop work and notice to comply, establishing that maximum penalty amount, and then developing that penalty schedule. So the bill requested that required that senior or executive staff level staff authorize stop work orders and notices and notices of penalty. The bill directed the department to identify the appropriate level of staff based on the financial effects to the violator and the scope and scale of the the impacts to fish life and habitat.
Let me help you out here.
No, thank you.
Mr. Baker.
Oh, hi.
Could you just refresh us? This is all about HPAs and all about how they are to be administered and maybe enforced. And I'm just assuming that that's mostly shoreline armoring and that kind of thing in marine areas. Could you just remind us how much more this bill applies to? And my specific question is, does this have anything at all to do? Is there any overlap with the suction dredge mining issues that we all dealt with in the last couple of years?
Yeah, I think the best way to answer that, so this bill and the authorities that were granted to the department apply to all projects that fall under the authority of the HPA program statewide. And Randy, maybe you can help me by giving some examples of some of the other types of projects.
So it would include, overwater structures, so the constructions of docks or pier ramps and floats, installation of mooring buoys, bank protection in freshwater, any mineral prospecting that's occurring in waters of the state.
Water crossings, any
culverts, bridges, so there's quite a few projects that are constructed in or near water that can affect the better flow of state waters, and that's where the authority is.
Maybe specific to your point about suction dredge mining. So suction dredge mining, as you recall from your significant effort before, is one of the project types that's falls under HPA authority. What we believe is that the rules that we have and the provisions that we put in place for suction dredge mining protect fish life and fish habitat. And so these new civil authorities apply and give us ways of requiring compliance with our rules when there is unpermitted work or when there is permitted work and there's a violation of that permit. So again, all that would go to, in the case of any of our projects, including suction dredge mining, meeting the requirements for fish protection that are in our rules.
Okay, thank you for that.
So for the signature authority, what we're proposing is that unpermitted work, we feel that it poses the highest risk of impacts to fish life, that regional habitat program managers and above have the ability to stop work for unpermitted work.
The objective there was that because we believe unpermitted work poses a higher risk, that we wanted to make sure that the ability to issue that stop work order was happening as close to the ground where the risk is posed. And so we did, as Randy said, include regional habitat program managers and regional directors in that signature authority. They know the ground. They're located there in the location.
So unpermitted work is work that doesn't fall under the requirements of HPAs. Is that correct? Or is it folks who are starting off and not knowing that they need the
It's work that where somebody's conducting a project without a permit. So they haven't secured the permit from us yet.
Got it. Okay.
For permitted work, we're proposing that regional directors, likely in consultation with the regional habitat program manager, again, keeping it at a local level where we can, have the ability to stop work. These are likely lower-risk projects, and they could have a significant economic impact on the violator. So we felt it was appropriate to have a higher level of a higher authority level look at these types of stop work orders before they're issued. Anything you want to add on that?
No, just to say that for permitted work, at the point that we've issued a permit, there is some property right by the permittee in that permit. So that's another layer of consideration in terms of whether to stop the work. And again, that's more likely that people higher in the agency with more authority have more understanding and awareness of those types of considerations for stop work.
Larry, I have another. There are a couple of pamphlet permits. Mm-hmm. How does that, because it's not, the assumption with a pamphlet permit is you're sort of trusting the person doing it to understand the pamphlet and mm-hmm. do it accordingly. So where does that fall in this risk here and signature authority?
So it would be a permitted activity. It would fall under the latter.
And again, stop work orders as a tool are applicable to any project that falls under mm-hmm. the HPA authority. And the distinction here is largely in terms of how low down in the senior management portion of the organization we're authorizing that. Please stop us. We'll continue to move on unless you guys have questions.
Challenged. So for this notice of penalty signature authority, first of all, I just want to reiterate, it's important to note that the bill and the department require the department to make all reasonable attempts to achieve voluntary compliance before issuing a civil penalty. The department may issue a civil penalty to a person who fails to complete the actions required in a correction request or a stop work order or notice to comply within that required time period. So usually there's an action required within a specified time period. Or if a person has conducted or is conducting a project without a permit. So those are the situations in which we would issue a penalty.
I'll add one nuance to that. Those are the instances where we can choose to issue a penalty. Mm-hmm. But again, our goal and objective is getting good fish habitat and fish protection on the ground. And so in some ways, a penalty is our last resort. The penalties don't go to if there has been damage that's occurred. They don't go to fixing that work on the ground. And so while we can issue a penalty in the case of somebody not getting an HPA and that unpermitted work that we spoke about, unless the situation is more egregious, we may still want to use some of those other tools like a notice to comply or a stop work order or both, which says stop that work and here's what you need to do to fix the damage that you've caused and come into compliance with the law.
Unlike the stop work orders, the penalties aren't as time sensitive. They still need to be issued in a timely manner, however. The department is proposing that violations that have a lower impact and a corresponding lower penalty amount be issued by the regional habitat program managers. And those violations that have a greater impact and a higher penalty amount would be issued by executive managers and headquarters who have kind of a broad, have broader authority and more kind of a more statewide perspective. Anything else you want to add? Okay. So the maximum penalty amount, when the governor vetoed some portions of the bill that were linked to the maximum penalty amount, he directed the department to use our rulemaking authority to establish a civil penalty not to exceed the penalty amount established in the original bill. We looked at the maximum penalties the other natural resources agencies have, and we determined that the maximum amount specified in the original bill was reasonable. So that's what we're proposing to add to the as language to the rules. That proposed rule specifies a penalty amount of up to $10,000 for every violation of the statute, which is 7755, or these rules, or provisions of an HPA. Each and every violation is a separate and distinct offense, and the penalties are issued in accordance with the penalty schedule, which I'll talk about next. Again, I do want to reiterate that it's up to $10,000 per violation. It's not $10,000 per violation per day like some of the other natural resources agencies have.
Maybe one additional point I'd like to offer. So we wanted to make sure that in both the maximum penalty amount and in the penalty schedule that Randy will go over next, that we were grounding the Department of Fish and Wildlife's approach well within the bounds of what existing natural resource agency compliance and civil programs are. And Randy and her team spent a lot of time looking at programs within the departments of ecology and natural resources and agriculture. And I want to emphasize what Randy just said. We were very conscious to be careful, particularly for a max penalty amount, because then you're talking about potential impacts to other people, financial impacts, that we wanted to ground ourselves there. There are, as Randy said, other natural resource agency penalty programs that are both higher in terms of maximum penalty amount and or have that compounding effect of max penalty per violation per day. So that grows each day that passes. That is not the case for the authority that the legislature gave us, nor what we're proposing here in terms of a maximum penalty. And we'd be happy to come back and answer questions about that as well.
All right. So the penalty schedule, when the department issues a civil penalty, the amount is based on the considerations that were specified in the bill. The first one is the previous violation history of the person. So this includes the frequency and similarity of any new any previous violations within the past 5 years. Preceding the violation, legalese here, a history of violations that show a pattern of disregard for specific HPA provisions or the law or the rules will likely result in a higher penalty amount.
Can you keep going?
Yep.
Okay, thank you.
When you briefed the Habitat Committee, I asked a question about, could you give an example about one of the really bad penalties, and you did, which I think that puts a perspective on this. Could you reiterate one of those severe cases?
Yeah, I have one in mind that may have been the one I shared, and then Randy's got a lot of experience too. So I think the one that I shared is actually one that also we prosecuted criminally. This was a case where over a weekend, a landowner who owned large equipment went in and basically rerouted the Tahuya River, and in doing so moved the water away from where there was significant spawning going on, thereby killing all the potential fish, right, that were in all those reds and gravel at the time. So it's an egregious risk where certainly in that case we'd be interested in the remedy and the compensation for what happened, which we're now able to do, as well as potentially a penalty.
Thanks. What I took away also from your briefing to the committee was that a lot of times people just think it's the heavy hand of government coming down and on and on. But you really have to earn one of these penalties, don't you? The severe ones. So I think that's a point that should, always be out there.
Absolutely. And that was why I emphasized, I think when we spoke before and today, that the legislature also agrees with that approach, and it's why they codified this sense of, look, use the tools to help people be in compliance. That's really our main goal, and fix the actual habitat and fish life on the ground. Some of these things are deterrents or remedies in those egregious cases. And I don't know if you have an example you want to provide.
You know, when I was a habitat biologist, I found most people want to comply, and sometimes they don't know that they've done something wrong in some cases, they're willing, more than willing, to fix it. So I can't think of a lot of times when a penalty would have been helpful. There is one case when I went out three different times to ask somebody to, basically they were constructing a new bulkhead, and they were leaving open a trench during times of low water, and it was summertime, and fish were being trapped in there, potentially. And so I asked him, you know, at three different occasions to please backfill that trench before the water recedes to make sure that the fish aren't trapped. And so that might be a case where you might want to consider a penalty because you've made the request several times. Yeah. So let's see. We talked about previous violation history. So the severity and repairability of the impacts. So if there are violations that injure or kill fish or decrease habitat function, value or quantity, or cause a long-term irreparable damage, this will likely result in a higher penalty amount. And then violations that are intentional. So violations that are intentional, foreseeable, where economic incentives are clear, or when precautions were not taken to avoid the impact, will likely result in a larger penalty amount. And then we also look at how well the person cooperated with the department. So if evidence of a person's poor or inconsistent cooperation with the department staff will likely result in a higher penalty amount, so they don't return your phone calls or those kinds of things. So the rules do allow for the department to decrease penalty amounts based on kind of the extent a person was unaware of the violation. So if I'm a landowner and I didn't know that my contractor was in violation, for example, or in cases where there's not an economic benefit from that violation, the manager could decrease the amount.
Commissioner Lindell.
So that brings in my mind, when there is a contractor doing the actual work, do both the contractor and the landowner get contacted during sort of the educational portion of this?
Yeah, I mean, that kind of goes more towards implementation, but and we still have a lot of kind of details to work out on implementation. But in my mind, if you're, you know, when I was a habitat biologist and I found that a contractor wasn't in compliance, I always let their landowner know as well, because both are usually listed on the permit. And I think their landowner should know and has a right to know what's going on the property.
Yeah. That was strongly suggest that. Yeah.
The legislature agrees to you. So there was one piece of the law that that made some process requirements, and it does require that when we issue any of the paperwork, whether it's a notice to comply, a stop work order, or a penalty, the law specifies who that paperwork has to go to, and it has to go to the violator. And if we determine that that's anybody other than the landowner on record, that it also goes to the landowner on record, as well as to the local government, the applicable local government, so that they also get a notice that this is happening.
Thank you.
Yeah, no problem.
Close to the last slide here. So we just wanted to talk a little bit about implementation. So as you recall, we received your approval to ask the legislature this session for additional funds to form a civil or administrative compliance unit. This unit would have dedicated staff that are specially trained to carry out compliance inspections and issue compliance requests. The staff would also recommend the issuance of stop work orders or notices to comply and notices of penalty when voluntary compliance isn't achieved. So they would make those recommendations to the appropriate managers.
I'm going to add a little bit to that. There have been a number of studies over the years looking at the effectiveness of the HPA program, definitely a couple even in the 17 or so years that I've been here. And every study that has looked at both the HPA program specifically and how to make it better, as well as just about any sort of general overview and look at regulatory programs that I've seen, has said that having knowledgeable people who can assist people to come into compliance is a really important part of it. We also did a small pilot that I think I may have talked with the committee about in Hood Canal, where we got a grant to have one staff person. So this was just one staff person and just looking at marine projects, largely bulkheads and overwater structures. And what we found is that when we had a person who could go out to the construction site at critical moments in construction, whether just before they're actually starting construction and actually during, when they still got equipment and people on site to make changes if need be, we got 100% compliance with permitted projects when we were providing that on-the-ground technical assistance. We also found that in having that one person available, when they were able to go out and do sort of routine work with our enforcement unit and do surveys of sort of common places where there often have been a lot of projects going on, they were also able to find some unpermitted projects and engage. Now, in a couple of those cases, when we didn't have these tools, those are examples of when it would have been helpful to have those tools to require people to come into compliance. But the reason I highlight that is because we have definitely seen in analyses of regulatory programs how important it is to have those people on the ground who are really trained in this work and focused on this work. So thank you for the support that you've provided to that. I think we've still got some work to do. That wasn't included in the governor's budget, but we're trying to continue working directly with the governor's office about how we can try to get that capacity for the agency.
So as Morgan said, I mean, environmental regulations are complicated, and the department has a responsibility to help the regulated community understand how to comply. So we currently have a technical assistance program. Our habitat biologists, who spend the majority of their time providing technical assistance, are a key component of that. We also have technical assistance program webpage that has applicant resources, and some of them are listed here. One of my goals for the HPA Citizen Advisory Group this year is to work with them to identify and prioritize how we can improve our technical assistance program. We really rely on them for their expertise and how we can better implement the program, and I think this fits really well with what their kind of goal and mission is to, you know, in helping us.
Well, when we come talk to you next to actually make a recommendation about rule adoption, we will, of course, go over the implementation plan that's required that would be specific to these rules. But some of you had asked questions and expressed interest in understanding how do we already reach out to people, provide good examples, help them know what the law is and how to comply. And so I really appreciated Randy and her team just pulling together some of those examples of what we do already.
And that wraps us up. So, additional questions?
Very good. We do have some public comment upcoming. Excellent. There are four people. I'm going to call you all up at one time. We have four chairs. I think if you don't know the rules, you get 3 minutes. You'll hear a little buzzer go off over in the corner. Please wrap up your sentence. and look forward to hearing from you. Rob Crable again, Amy Carey, Hannah Markley, and Jay Roberts.
All right. Good afternoon, commissioners. Rob Crable, Northwest Representative with Defenders of Wildlife, providing public comments generally to support the rules that were just presented to you. I had the privilege to serve on the prey working group of the Orca Task Force along with Amy, and that's where this initial idea was first sort of cooked up. And through the Orca Task Force process and the legislative process, Defenders of Wildlife and our allies in the Environmental Priorities Coalition and the Orca Salmon Alliance have supported this the full way through, so we're really happy to see these rules written today. I think that it will provide the department with a lot more tools in their toolbox to enforce these rules and greater ability to enforce negligence when it occurs on the land. A few things that I would just say about this is I think that this underscores the importance of looking through a lot of the different rules and regulations that the department has. Something that came up time and time again during the Orca Task Force discussion is that the state has a lot of really good laws on the books, but we don't always do the best job at enforcing it. This sort of fix, switching from criminal to civil enforcement, was one of those mechanisms to increase compliance and enforcement for these regulations, and there's a lot more that we can be doing. Also want to express my appreciation to the Habitat Department staff for their great work on these rules and looking forward to working with them on a host of other issues that the Orca Task Force put out in terms of improving habitat for our salmon. The last thing that I will say, and Commissioner Linville, this gets to a point earlier today, is that I think this is another good example to bring up to the legislature about the need for greater funding for the department. The legislature passed a lot of things for the department to be doing in regards to orca and salmon, but did not provide you with enough funding to actually implement it. And as was just stated by staff, there's a lot of enforcement that needs to go on and monitoring. And in the lieu of additional funding, I think that the department has a lot of opportunities for partnerships to work with other organizations. As a proud Tacoman, I'm very proud to say that the Pierce Conservation District, which is the top conservation district in the state second year in a row, has a really great shoreline program that they just started up and can help with some of this education, outreach, and compliance. So I would encourage the department to also work with those folks who are on the ground. So really happy about this and very supportive of this, and hope that the commission improves these rules.
Thank you, Rob. Amy?
My name is Amy Carey, and I am the director of an environmental group called Sound Action. We work specifically on nearshore marine nearshore habitat and species protection through the application of regulatory and environmental laws. And we have a very clear lens on the hydraulic code with that and the HPAs. We actually review every single marine HPA that's in the Puget Sound and Salish Sea portion of Washington State. So that's a lot in our heads. But it gives us a really unique, I think, perspective and view, too, to what are we seeing, what's needed, how can the department be strengthened. And with Rob, we were really honored to be a part of the Prey Work Group supporting the Orca Task Force. And the recommendations for both what we're talking about right now of repealing some of the sort of troubling bulkhead laws that were on the books, and then also the civil authority, was probably one of the first and strongest things that came up in our year one actions, and went all the way through a lot of review with a lot of different user groups and interests, which I think is also important, that these recommendations were put forward then to the task force and then to the legislature. We worked to get that passed. I think that we cannot emphasize strongly enough how important this is for salmon and orca recovery, these actions. There's a lot more work to do, but as a starting point, this is so significant. And particularly since this legislation was passed, three more whales have died. We're at 73 whales right now. So we're here in strong support. I'd also share that I also sit on the Hydraulic Code, the Implementation Committee, the Citizens Advisory Group. And can also tell you that the department's done a really good job already with really kind of reaching out to a lot of folks and being, I think, very careful as how they're looking to apply these, particularly the civil enforcement rules, fairly and evenly. So I just want to echo what Rob was saying, too, of here to in strong support and
and really hope that as it moves to final adoption time that we can all work together to give the department the tools that we all need to help salmon and orcas.
Thank you. Hannah?
Hi, I'm Hannah Markley. I'm here on behalf of the Home Builders, the Building Industry Association of Washington, and I just have a couple of comments. First of all, I'm really glad that WDFW recognizes the importance of pre-fine education and the value of bringing people on board and compliance as a way to actually accomplish the goal instead of compliance as a way to garner penalty amounts. That's really reassuring. There are a couple technical problems with the rules that I'd like to emphasize that pose a little bit of a risk for BIAW members. First, the agency is attempting to enact a version of the bill, HB 1579, which didn't pass. As the governor stated in his veto message, the rules are based on the original bill, which never passed in the Senate. This is really concerning for us, as it's a procedural issue that kind of undermines the entire rest of the rules system, and want to bring that to the commission's attention. The other issue is, as the staff pointed out, implementing the will of the legislature is very important. And that's the overall goal, but the will of the legislature is rather unclear after the governor's veto, because there is no specific penalty amount included anymore now that the veto has been removed and now that the original bill wasn't actually enacted. The last major issue that I see with the rules is that the project proponent definition includes multiple parties, which is fine, except that it isn't clear from the rule whether the fines would be to multiple parties in equal amount. It isn't clear who would be the recipient of what fine, and if it is the agency's intent to say that all parties are equally responsible, we would have a problem with that, because different parties have different amounts and would be disincentivized in different ways. So it would be very helpful to the home building industry if the agency could specify, for example, that all parties will be given an exact amount of the fine amount that would be assessed to them. And that would be a useful change that could be made. Thank you.
Thank you. Jay?
Thank you. My name is Jay Roberts. I am a builder on Whidbey Island, and I build mainly Island County and Skagit County. And obviously, being on an island, a lot of what I build is along the water. And with this bill, part of the challenges that we have are with prospective clients who don't understand any of these rules, who rely upon their builders to explain these rules to them. And the rules as they're written as of now are very vague. And so for me to explain the rules to somebody is going to be almost impossible at an initial meeting. The challenge with those is the majority of the people don't live in our county. They're people who've moved from somewhere else to our county and live on the island. So we'd ask that some of these rules be clarified as to what they are. We, as a general contractor, do have DFW come to our job sites and take a look at what we have, but even those inspectors at times don't have clarity as to what the rules are. As Hannah said, another one of our challenges is at $10,000 being the maximum rule, the maximum penalty, we have to let our prospective clients know that there's a possibility that that could happen. Obviously, we will always do our best to make sure that we don't step over the line for any of the rules that have been implemented. But again, if we don't know what they are, we're not quite sure what those rules are going to be. We need to forewarn our prospective clients who have probably never built a house along the water what the possibility of those can be. So as we ask is, what is going to be the structure for the fines? On one of the slides here, it talked about cooperation with the inspector. We all have bad days. We want to make sure we don't have those bad days. But since we don't know what the rules or the fines are going to be, again, I'm always going to assume that a fine is going to be the maximum fine until I hear otherwise. I'm not a big general contractor. If I get a $10,000 fine, and as Hannah said, is it going to be the homeowner, the customer, the excavator, whoever was working? If there's five people, is that $50,000 per day? We're not sure. So we ask for some clarity on what these fines are going to be and what the rules are going to be. Again, we're all on the same page. We want to preserve salmon habitat. We just want to play by the same playbook. Thank you.
Thank you all. Appreciate your comments.
Question for staff.
Mr. Thorburn.
Sort of brings it up again. I want to return to the compliance unit proposal. And a little, I know you've said that you have a lot to work out in terms of implementation, but what sort of overview are you envisioning that would it be ideally enough staff so that they could be out just sort of sporadically doing inspections, or would it be during project development that they would be on the ground? I'm thinking of pamphlet users, you know, as we were trying to get a handle on number of suction dredgers who were using the pamphlet. Would they be out looking for those kinds of things?
So that is a great question. The actual proposal that we submitted to the governor's office was for, I believe, one lead to manage the compliance unit and ensure consistency and supervision, and I believe 8 compliance inspectors who would be have a biological background as well, so they can actually make these recommendations about what would be fixed. I hear in your questions about, well, what is the strategy then, and how do you deploy those resources? I think some of the early conversations we have had, we are talking about one compliance inspector for each of the WDFW regions, except in the Puget Sound, having a few more. And that was based on when we look at the numbers of HPAs statewide and where are their hotspots just by virtue of more activity. It's really that Puget Sound and I-5 corridor. So that's the first sort of filter of how do you deploy these resources. I think the other thing we've talked about is, and again, this is just general, and I'll look to Randy because I think she's thought about even more of the detail and talked a little bit with our citizen advisory group about these kinds of things. But where do we know that there's either or both very high risk to fish resources? So, for example, we all in all of our work, including the commission, have been talking about places like the Stillaguamish, where we know we have high concern for all sorts of reasons. And so we talked about trying to concentrate compliance inspector time in places like that. I think the other thing we would need to look at, and this is a place where we probably also need to do a little bit of work with enforcement and see if our enforcement program has some other insights to help us with, but looking at where have there been hot spots in the past for lack of compliance, and that could also, that could be geographic locations, or that could be if we know that there's a particular entity, a local government or a particular contractor that we've been trying to work with to help them be in compliance, we might prioritize some permits that they have to be there on hand for them and help them. If you want to add.
I guess the only thing I would add is kind of prior to that project being constructed, the habitat biologists often go out and do pre-project construction meetings with the contractors and homeowners or landowners. And during that time, they're providing technical assistance, answering questions, making sure folks, you know, understand their permit or if they have questions about them, answering those. So,
Commissioner Linville and Commissioner Grayville.
So I have a bit of a comment. When I'm over here on this side of the state, I can see why, like, people are probably like, oh my gosh, it's a no-brainer what's a shoreline project and what's not and what is going to, you know, impact waters. But when you live in arid parts of eastern Washington, I'll give you a very specific example, which we have we call it the flood ditch. DFW calls it Douglas Creek that runs through our entire ranch, and it is dry all year except maybe 4 or 5 days out of the year when we have floodwaters running through it, which is still important because it does empty out into the Columbia River still. So those 4 or 5 days of floodwater do. So I just want to paint a little bit different picture because I know that it seems like silly that you wouldn't know that you needed an HPA. But in arid parts of the state, I really appreciate this. I'm hoping this happens because people may legitimately not even think that they need an HPA for a dry flood ditch. And so I just wanted to kind of paint a little bit different picture because it's a little bit less clear in different parts of the state. So I appreciate this. I'm wildly excited about it. It's going to be good.
If I may respond, those are really important points, and I think a little bit I appreciated Mr. Roberts' testimony as well. I don't think it's silly to think that an individual landowner or small contractor that doesn't do a lot of this type of work might not know. And so the questions to us and our thinking about how are we helping people know about that are important. And I think about a couple of strategies, some of which we have already started, but I think can sort of double down on and improve. One of which is thinking about our outreach strategies and having pamphlets on hand that we can give in mass to people. When we first started that, we were thinking about the permit counters of local governments, which is really important. But this whole civil rulemaking has also, I think, made us think about how do we reach out to contractors, realtors, conservation districts, people who we know may be in a position to help landowners or need to know themselves. The other thing I think about in terms of a couple of additional tools, we've been trying to think about having for our own staff to make sure our staff are knowledgeable, clear guidance about when the authority applies so that they're able to give good technical assistance. That's not something that, at least as we started that we envisioned as something to post online, but we can think about that and getting some version of that out there for people to see. The other thing I wanted to mention is looping all the way back. So Randy mentioned that in this particular rulemaking, we're implementing direction from the legislature to have a pre-permit consultation where people can ask us formally to make a call about whether they need to get a permit, and we have to issue a decision within 15 days. So that's something that's important for contractors to know as well, so that if you're ever in doubt, the legislature has now actually created a mechanism to prompt the department to make a formal call, and that should make things easier as well.
You mentioned public outreach, and I think that once these rules are in place, it may be very helpful to offer meetings with contractors, mm-hmm. Such as yourself there, to be able to sit down, review these new rules, get an understanding. You know, there's probably some common threads amongst his business that he's familiar with that he could share with the department and get clarity. It's not unusual for our people in the field to not be quite clear on what these rules mean. And so it's onus is on us to clarify that with our staff, mm-hmm. and to be able to accurately share that with our people in the field and with the businesses that are and property owners that are impacted. And I just the better effort we do that on the front end, we won't wind up, say, with the kind of multi-county lawsuit against the department about uncertainty that these rules are being applied equally, or, you know. So this is an opportunity, as soon as these rules are in place, to offer the opportunity for businesses, county officials, all those other agencies that could be impacted by this work, that they are briefed and they get clarity on what this means.
Great, thanks.
Okay, last comment, Commissioner Smith.
Continuing that stream of thought from Commissioner Graybill and outreach, we're not the only state facing these sorts of issues. So I would encourage to talk to representatives from the BIA and the business world if they know other states and that are doing this, and look at best practices in other states, because there could be mechanisms of outreach that are very successful in Florida or, you know, Oregon or something. But I don't know the answer, but I think doing a little due diligence on some other best practices could help us in the goal that Commissioner Graybill was saying about getting out in front of this.
Chair Smith, we do have a member of the BIAW on our citizen advisory group, so I think that's a we can engage them in that.
And one up in the
panel. Yeah.
Randy, Morgan, thank you very much. Nice
welcome.
Presentation.
Thank you.
So much.